What the proportion of national service to
regular? 95%. The if you took, you'd have the senior, there'd be the senior, we had national service subalterns. I would think half the junior officers were national service. I had a friend in the Hallamshires later who got a military cross as a national service subaltern on the next hill with the Durham Light Infantry, at the same time as General de la Billière of Gulf fame was also subaltern with the DLI on that hill. The sergeant's mess, there would be about 30 experienced ex-wartime. I went to Germany as a volunteer in a draft of 45 regulars who were being sent out to sort of strengthen the mix. But I wouldn't think there'd be more than 200 regulars in the ranks from corporal and below. So of the if we said 200 regulars, 30 sergeants and 20 officers, so that's 250 out of 850 would be regulars. The rest would be national service, which would be 600. So that's what 70% national service. But that this was typical of all the battalions in Korea at the time. And the quality of soldiering was very good, I think, in the circumstances. it was partly that kept me in the Territorial Army afterwards, because my family had no soldiering background. And I came back filled with respect for British Army methods. And handling, you know, everything that there was about it. And so I did another 36 years as a territorial. Well, now, the Samichon agents. These were men who walked up the Samichon, usually up to their knees or beyond in water, and they walked a good 15 kilometres because it provided a roadway through the Chinese lines.
Samichon River.
Yes. I knew Rodney Harms had disappeared in the middle of the night occasionally with the jeep. But he didn't say anything about it until one day he said to me that he had to go off, and he wanted me to take the jeep to a grid reference on the Samichon, which was unmanned and so on. And I had to leave at 3 o'clock in the morning, and to be in position an hour before first light, and to be at the end of the jeep head, which is just a rough track, by the Samichon, and as soon as I should drive only on side lights, and as soon as I got there, switch off and just wait, and I'd be contacted. Anyway, as the light came up, and I walked down towards the river, which was about 100 yards away, and over on my right, that was upstream and towards the Chinese lines, a chap got up out of the reeds. He'd been on his knees or lying in the water. It must have been freezing because it was December. And big flat straw hat, sort of black cloak wrapped around his shoulders, and a staff. And he came towards me, and I gave the password, and he answered to challenge and password, and we put him in the jeep, and luckily, I think it was Pickles, this was the adjutant's driver, it wasn't Jenny, and got a blanket in the back. We put him in the blanket and we took him back to divisional headquarters, where they had what was called an agent's village, which was, I remember, it was still just getting light, and we dropped him off, and I was supposed to be out of there before it was fully daylight. But I mean, dawn and dusk was only 10 minutes at that latitude, so. But it was still mist, and and I have this memory of being at the river. I suppose I might have done this 3 times, and where the thin mist rising off the water, and then out the mist comes this ghostly apparition with his staff, and the water up to just below his knees, but these chaps, they had no weapons, they had no radio. They had no identity papers. They spoke Korean, and they were Korean. And one of them, I remember, spoke very good English, and he said he'd lived in America for a number of years. But they went out for 3 weeks at a time, and apparently their timings were set by the moon, the phase of the moon. And we converted them to dates, of course, and we operated on dates. And they went in for at least 11 days and then came back out again, and sometimes they got 100, 200 kilometres up into North Korea and evaded detection and so on. And the American one, I said, well, how do you manage? And they said, well, we're Koreans as far as he said, we try to act like them, and we try to avoid contact, we just use our eyes and ears and see what's going on, and then come back and report it. And I said, well, how can you pinpoint anything? He said, well, he said, we haven't a map. He said, but we've been well briefed on the lay of the land and the towns and villages in there, and we can talk to people occasionally. And we know roughly where we are and where we're going, and we can identify that the Samichon is our guide and its tributaries, and we can work things out from that. But it struck me as being an incredibly brave thing to do, because, you know, if they were caught, it would be shot immediately.
Were they just acting as passive observers then?
Sorry?
They were just acting as passive observers.
Yes. Yes, and but they could, they would be able to identify battery fire positions, because the Chinese had 155mm guns, the same as us, and tank concentrations and troop movements generally, that would be a big help. They would get in, I would think, about 50 miles behind the Hook salient and north of it, and I think the Gloucester Valley was rumoured to be part of the I'm trying to think of the name of the Chinese hordes that swarmed across Europe. The emperor, what was his name?
The Mongols.
The Mongols, yes.
Mongols, sorry.
The Mongols, yes. They called it the not like the Ho Chi Minh train, but it went back to the 13th century and that came down through Gloucester Valley to Seoul, and I heard these agents mention that trail, which was the main service road, the main supply route for the Hook salient area, where they seem to have most of their battles. There were only two battlefields in the Commonwealth Division sector. That was the Hook on the left of the divisional position, and 0.355 on the other side, and behind that was a higher peak called Kamak San, which had an American intercept radio station there with Chinese speaking operators. And in fact, when we were on the Hook battle the following May, most of our information came through the intercept. We got better information about what was happening in the battle than we were getting from our own rifle companies, because the 31 sets, which operated between rifle company and battalion headquarters, had a maximum range of only about 15 kilometres. And of course, in the thick of events, the soldiers forgot about them, or officers didn't use them. And so we knew hardly anything of what was going on. It was but valuable strategic information was coming through the intercept net as the Chinese committed another battalion, and you know, and because we knew that the Chinese, for example, that only one man in four would have a Tommy gun, a Russian PPSH-44, and one would have a rifle. One might have a pistol or something else, but the third would, the fourth would have a cudgel, and he was expected to get a weapon off one of his fallen comrades before he got into the enemy lines, the third man would have grenades, we knew that they weren't all that well armed. And they carried a week's food with them, which made it easy for them. They had a sort of sandbag about drain pipe diameter, 4 inches, which they slung and tied over the shoulder like a bandolier and tied at the bottom. And that had 7 days of rice in it. And they had some dried vegetables and a little fish oil. And that was a week's rations. They discarded those when they went into battle, but the rest of the time they carried them. And of course, and their uniform was kapok, padded in the winter, and with textile boots, but faced with rubber, rubber coming, say, 50 centimetres up the side and ankle. I remember it well because of a practical joke played on me once on the hook when we were we just moved in and we were digging out the positions and deepening the communication trench and so on, when a chap at the top of the hill on the reverse slope shouted, "You've got Isaac down there, have you?" That, this was my nickname. "Haven't you?" And he said, "Yes, he's in the int section, supposed to recognise enemy property, isn't he?" She said, "Yes." They said, "Give him this," and this thing came through hand to hand, and it was a Chinese boot, but it still had the foot in it from one of the previous battles. And it was as I describe it, they all rolled with laughter. Such a soldier's practical joke.
Were you aware of the Chinese or North Koreans operating agents through your lines?
Yes. The North Korean? No, we didn't. There was nothing suspected. We don't think they were doing the same thing. I mean, they could have used the same route, but I've got a map upstairs somewhere of 25,000 map of the area, which I stuck together, and I told myself years ago that I'd keep it and I'd memorise the platoon positions and so on. But I don't think now I could do it. I'm certainly the Samichons there. But you had the Yongdong position and you had the Hook position, and the Samichon running between. These were low hills, and you had about a kilometre of open ground. But in front of that, you probably had about 5 kilometres before the Chinese position started, because it was all flat floodplain, and you couldn't occupy it. And in fact, after the Hook. I once thought I was putting my neck in a noose when I refused to do a patrol into no man's land. You were asked to volunteer for these things, and of course you were expected to accept the invitation. But I was asked to go out with a subaltern from my old company from the Hook position into the hills behind. The hills behind weren't occupied. I knew that for two reasons. That we moved into Yongdong and relieved the Welsh regiment. The sniper sergeant of the Welsh regiment was a very belligerent fellow. And on his own, he used to walk across these floodlines and go into those hills opposite And he had been there and said those hills bordering on the Shamichon. You've got, say the finger, that's the scarp slope, and you've got the river running along here, and we're across here, about 3 kilometres away. Now, he'd gone on this hill, which ran parallel to the Hook Hills, which were here, and found that for about 500 yards they weren't occupied. There were some fortifications, but not manned. There was no point. On top of that, I could see it from the aerial photographs. I did a course with the American Marines in aerial photograph interpretation. Rodney Harms, the EIO, sent me, and because the Americans used aerial photographs a great deal. And I'm trying to remember just exactly when, I think it would be when we're on the Nha Chon position in February. But I went on this course, a private soldier, and I met at divisional headquarters, I met Corporal Pete Maillon, Van Deuxième Régiment du Pied de Canada, Quebec. And he and I were the only two Brits amongst the Americans. But the Americans, there were about 30 on the course, top sergeants down, mostly sergeants from various units, including gunner units, but mostly Marines. The night before the end of the course, there was an exam, when there was going to be an exam in the morning, they all went off boozing. And being an XA level student, I spent the evening going through my notes. And it turned out I got 100% in the written exam and 76% in the practical, which made me top of the course, which surprised these Americans a bit. That the lowest rank on the course should be the top man on the course. And they said things like, gee, fella, is all the British Army like you? And I'd played dumb and I'd say, what do you mean, like me? They said, well, you know, you've done very well in this. I said, well, it speaks for itself. They're all a damn sight better than I am. I'm a private soldier. And anyway, I got back. And I was interviewed by the CO, and which is a surprise. He said, you've got a very good report, Winspear. He said, and you've done very well. But I think I should tell you that in the British Army, only officers are allowed to interpret aerial photographs. I said, thank you, sir. I'll bear that in mind. And he said, anyway, he said, because you've done well, I suppose I'll have to make you an acting unpaid provisional Lance Corporal. And anyway, it a bit later on, I had the then battle adjutant, who was a Captain Glenn, who was killed in the Hook battle. And I refused to do the patrol with him that he was killed on. And my boss, who by that time was Sergeant Major Cork, because Rodney Harms had gone back to England to get his military cross, that I could mention a bit later on if you like, to collect it off the Queen. And the patrol that we started with was going to be done by Mike Campbell-Lamberton, who was a junior Scottish rugby international, ended up captaining the British Lions against the All Blacks. And I was ordered by the CO to change balls and pack with them in the second row for when we played the Kiwis, the Kiwi gunners, when we were out in reserve after that first position on Yongdong. I said to the CO, I said, have you seen the size of his feet? He took about a size 12. I'm a 10, and I was a 9 then. And he said, what do you mean? And I said, well, he's got very big feet, and he might be a good rugby player, but from I can't imagine he's much of a poacher. He said, what's that got to do with it? I said, well, I've got to go out with him in no man's land, and he's going to make a lot of noise. And he's not the best of chaps to go on this kind of errand. I said, I take it he's volunteered. She said, yes. He didn't answer that sort of question from a private soldier, but I probably was then. And I said, anyway, those hills are empty. And I told him what I did. And I said, it's not worth the risk. And he said, so you don't want to go? I said, well, I'm sorry, sir, but I think it's pointless. And I mean, a private soldier telling the colonel is a bit naughty, but anyway, that was it. Very well, he said, off you go. And it was cancelled. But Captain Glenn took a sapper corporal out into no man's land to see if the forming up positions in the caves that were being dug at the back of Warsaw, which was the next position. Do you know the Korean feature? They always used it as their forming up position, and they dug caves.
The Chinese forming up.
Yes, yeah. They dug five caves, and each one was capable of taking about 120 men. And Captain Glenn, who had fallen from grace as a battle adjutant, but not for military reasons, we had an ENSA group come to entertain us, and there was a particularly attractive blonde singer, and he'd taken her home to Div headquarters and didn't come back till very early the next morning, and the CO didn't like it and told him off and posted him as second in command to a rifle company, and he lost his job as battle adjutant, which was a sort of, so he was trying to get win back his spurs, which anyway, the he asked me to go with him. Now, I had another skill which had become known by this time. I was very good at night with a compass, and I'd trained people in Germany in orienteering, which was barely known at that time, but I'd done map making and surveying in A-level geography and knew these skills, which I used in Korea to map the minefields, which had been laid, marked, and never mapped. So any position that the Dukes occupied, I mapped the minefields, and when we moved on, we handed a copy of that map over to the... and it meant I could do most of it, not by theodolites, because we didn't have one anyway, but by prismatic compass. I could mark the extremities, but I needed some measurements to confirm the positions, which I used to do by going out with a patrol on when things were quiet, and I'd stand up and walk regulation pace of 30 inches and measure my paces down the side of a minefield. One of the dimensions was enough usually, and remember the number and then multiply them up when I got back and plot it accurately, and I would guarantee their accuracy down to a meter, which is not bad in those circumstances. And and this is why I was in demand for some of these patrols, and I knew the ground as well. I mean, I knew it like the back of my hand, really. I could be anywhere and know where everything was in relation to it. Partly having been there, and partly having looked at it and studied on the aerial photographs, etc. But this Captain Glenn had approached me earlier, and he said, look, there's a new machine gun position here. And and I got the stereoscope out and the oblique and checked it. And I said, well, I don't think I agree, sir. And he said, why not? Of course it is. And I said, well, normally there's a splay of the fire firing aperture, which and there's no indication of that. There's no new digging here, and they might have camouflaged it. But what it was a Korean burial mound. They were about the length of this, perhaps beside this carpet, and they were usually egg-shaped. It rose up about a metre, and the earth that had been thrown in the middle, some of it was thrown at the sides, and so it had a little earth wall around it. And they thought it was what in Arab countries, I think, a sangha, made with stones, and you'd machine gun fires over the top. But I didn't want to tell him that because, but the shadow was in the wrong place and so on, because you read aerial photographs from the shadows, not from anything else, basically. And if you have obliques and so on, which are shown from an angle and at different times of day, you can confirm these things. Anyway, it is, and the same after again, between moving from Myeongdong to Naecheon, we had to do a divisional exercise of relief of the right-hand battalion on 355 in case it was overrun. And this meant going up the long valley behind it in the night and on sidelights, and this snake of vehicles with the two tiny eyes stretched for miles and so on. But when we pulled off the road and got in daylight, and I'd tried my lads, who'd been reinforced by another two by this time, and we could use the snipers, and they were six, and travelled with us in a three-tonner. I'd trained them so that when the vehicle stopped, they got the camouflage nets out and so on, and we could be fully operation and with the telephone hooked up and everything within 5 minutes of stopping. And the next thing was the battle agent comes round. He said, "I just thought I'd confirm our position on the map with you, Winspear." And he showed me. I looked at my map and I said, "Well, sir," "if we were in your position, look there, take a line across that, there'd be that spur in the way, and we wouldn't be able to see that bridge there that we can see here. We've got to be a kilometre this way." Anyway, he said, and off he went. About an hour later, the brigadier comes up fuming. I've wasted a bloody half hour looking for the Duke of Wellington's headquarters. You're not where you say you are." And so his map reading wasn't all that good, but there we are. A pity he got killed. The battle started while they were out in no man's land, and the defensive fire had to be put down, our own. And he was hit by a several pieces of shrapnel, and the sapper corporal carried him back, and he got a military medal. But he was very lucky to get back at all. I think he got some shrapnel in his legs as well. But not a nice way to go, but winning back your spurs in the front line is always a dangerous business.
What sort of mines were used?
Mines. Two types, anti-tank and anti-personnel, basically. The anti-personnel were two types. They were butterfly bombs and shoe mines, which are wooden and plastic shoe. But the original ones, shoe is the German shoe. Only about 2 inches of explosive. Right, so what should we do next?
Just on the subject of mines still, how effective were they?
My short answer would be not very. They inhibited our activities in no man's land. The Chinese used them against us. They'd pin us against our own minefields. Our fighting patrols were 15 men. Theirs were 45. And the only way out was across a minefield. And I was on one of my minefield jaunts once when this happened.